This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. In today's program, we have a nuclear roundup with Arne Gundersen on this day when there are new problems with the spent fuel tank at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4. We'll be covering that as well as the domestic nuclear situation. Also today, there were special meetings at the United Nations over the situation in Syria. We'll be discussing that with Elaine Hagopian, a Syrian scholar, on the many inputs and influences on the turmoil and instability there. All of that and more on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we are now joined live by Arne Gundersen, a nuclear engineer, a licensed plant operator, expert witness, and technologist of the consultancy organization Fairwinds Associates based in Vermont. And Arne, it is so good to have you back. There's so much going on in the world. Welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Hi, Robert. Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Well, let's begin with an issue of some concern that we discussed not so long ago, and that is the rockabye baby overstuffed spent fuel tank that is perched high atop a structurally unsound building that has had its outer edifice blown away. And now there are new alarming thermal problems. What is the very latest you know about that?
Well, let's back up just a hair and realize that when you shut a nuclear reactor down, you don't make the heat go away because, the chain reaction has stopped. The pieces that are broken off, called fission products, stay hot. So the fuel pool at Unit 4 is not undergoing a chain reaction, but there's enough pieces from previous fissions that it remains very, very hot. Well, what happened this week is that both of the cooling pumps failed, and now the temperature has gone up about 10 degrees Celsius, or about 18 degrees in the last 2 days. It still has got a couple of days to go before it boils, and hopefully they'll buy some new pumps at the True Value or something like that before it gets to that point. But you know, this is a jury-rigged system. The original system was blown to smithereens last year, and they've simply jury-rigged pipe together. And the main pump failed on Tuesday, and the backup pump failed on Wednesday.
This is following their attempt to cool things down with a fire hose, correct?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, the backup is that if it starts to boil, they'll squirt water in through a fire hose to prevent it from boiling dry. But I think the bigger picture is what you talked about at the first couple sentences of your rockabye baby scenario. The building is damaged, and it's actually TEPCO, Tokyo Electric, has announced that it's bulging on the side. While the fuel pool seems to be flat right now, the building has developed a bulge in it. So if there's a seismic event, the pool might crack, in which case a fire hose is not going to keep filling it, or the building could collapse, in which case we're where no science has gone before. No one has ever anticipated several nuclear reactor cores lying out on the ground, unable to be cooled. So it could easily result in a large portion of Japan being uninhabitable because the fuel will catch fire.
There was a situation where the spent fuel pool number 4 was overloaded because of the removal of fuel from yet another reactor. And Arne, I'm uncertain which scenario would be for the better. If the pool stays inside the building without collapsing, and the water is unable to be brought in to keep it cool, then you have a lot of fuel proximate to each other, the pellets and the rods. And if it falls, then presumably these rods would scatter at a greater distance from each other. What is the difference between those two scenarios?
I think it's better if the fuel stays proximate to each other. But if it falls, I don't think it will scatter. I think it'll just fall into a lump that will be uncoolable, which is the worst case, because then, of course, the center of it is, it can't be, would increase in temperature to the point where the zirconium clad could catch fire. This has been studied before. Brookhaven National Labs, right near New York City, studied a fuel pool fire, and they were talking about having to, 186,000 people may develop cancer as a result. And that was less radioactive material in the fuel pool they studied than what's in Fukushima. So it's, I tell my friends in Japan, when you wake up every morning, take a look at the live cameras and make sure Unit 4 is still standing. And if it is, you can go to work that day. But if it's not, have a backup plan.
Well, there is more to the issue of cool, clear water and the maintenance of a cooling system and the pumping and circulation of water. And I understand that you have learned that there has been a failure of that potential in many other places than merely Unit 4 of Fukushima Daiichi.
Yeah, I was talking about this on CNN the very first week of the accident. The tsunami, the industry would like you to believe that the tsunami wiped out the diesels. They flooded the diesels, and nobody has diesels placed like that, so therefore we don't have to worry. But that's not what happened. The tsunami wiped out the pumps that are near the water. They're called service water pumps. And they and every plant has to have the pumps near the water because that's where the water is. So the these service water pumps were destroyed. And at Fukushima Daiichi, which means Fukushima 1, there were 6 units. In Fukushima Daini, means Fukushima 2, there were 4 units. A little further down the coast was a plant called Anagawa, which had 3 units, and a little further down the coast was a plant called Tokai, which had 1 unit. So that's 15 nuclear units. The pumps that cool the diesels failed on most of those, and 24 of the 36 diesels between those 15 nuclear plants were wiped out. So we almost had 15 meltdowns and not 3. It would have been species-threatening had we had that occurred. We really came way too close.
We're speaking with Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. He is also the author of the Japanese bestseller in the Japanese language that is called Fukushima, The Truth and the Future. And Arnie, there is yet another consequence of conditions in Japan that is a matter of concern for the entire planet. We have recently read scientific reports saying that blue-tail tuna have now swum across the Pacific Ocean in their seasonal migrational patterns, and that they have been found with elevated levels of cesium, I think 137 and 34, that could be characteristic only of the effluents that is still going into the Pacific from the Fukushima site. I remember we spoke a long time ago, and you warned us that we had 1 year to have our last Pacific tuna if we did not want to be irradiated. What is your understanding of the oceanic issue here?
Yeah, it's probably more serious than what you just said. It's truly frightening. What happened was these fish were caught back 5 months after the accident. So an accident happened in March, April, May, June, July, August. The fish were caught in August and analyzed in August, but the research wasn't published until June of this year. So it's not like these fish were caught recently. The scientists sat on this information for 8 or 9 months while they were waiting to get their report published. So what happened was right after the accident, these fish picked up some radiation and then started to swim east. And they were caught 4 months later off of San Francisco. Now they got a little bigger and they excreted some of that cesium, but they still had body burdens of both kinds of cesium, 134 and 137, that were surprisingly high for a fish that had only been near Fukushima for a couple weeks. So my question is, what's been going on since then? Because we know the cesium has been continually being released from groundwater leaks into the ocean, as well as being deposited from all these plumes. It's likely that the next catch of tuna that hasn't made the scientific literature yet is going to be worse than the tuna that they caught. They caught 15 tuna, and all 15 had high levels of cesium-134 and 137 in them. So it wasn't just... I'd like to say a fluke, but that's a fish too.
No, we're talking about, Arnie, we're talking about not flukes, but hot tuna.
Right. So it wasn't just a scientific anomaly. They went 15 for 15, and every one of these tuna was had high levels of cesium-134 and 137. And that both of those isotopes are there is the Fukushima signature. You know, we are sure the Daiichi accident caused those tuna to become contaminated.
There's another matter of concern here. You spoke about the levels measured in this set of samples having perhaps previously been greater because the tuna may have excreted some of the material with the cesium, radioactive cesium in it. But what troubles me even about that scenario is this. We know that the larger fish, the blue tail, the yellowfin tunas, are large fish that the radioactive material that goes down to the bottom that is consumed by plankton or by crustaceans or scavengers makes its way up the food chain as increasingly larger fish eat the smaller things. So, I mean, is it possible to say even that the excreted cesium is outside of the food chain?
Yes, it's certainly, they've already detected it in the water column from the surface all the way down to the bottom of the ocean, and are seeing it in all of the things you were talking about, in the plankton, in the snails, they actually have something they call snow. And it's just particles that were deposited on the water, and they're working their way down through the water column, and it's loaded with cesium, which these tuna and other fish are swimming through. So the concentration in the small fish is actually higher than these tuna. So one would expect that now, as more and more tuna start to swim toward the United States, we'll see higher and higher levels of radioactivity in the tuna. And I don't think that trend is going to stop for the next several years.
Arnie, there's one other thing relative to Fukushima that I feel we must cover, and that is the airborne contamination that accompanied the earliest days and months of the disaster at Fukushima. And how does the scale of the atmospheric propagation of the contamination factor into the risk the entire planet is at?
Well, the atmospheric numbers are down this year. You know, the worst atmospheric numbers came in March, April, and May. And as far as the U.S. goes, the worst area that got hit was the Cascade Range on the West Coast. The plants now are releasing relatively little amounts of airborne radiation. The basements are still leaking like sieves and into the groundwater and into the ocean, but the airborne releases now are much less than they were back in March, April, and May. So, what's on the ground now in the Cascades is about as bad as you can expect, and it will go down with time. Whereas that's not true with the fish and the what's going on in the ocean. Woods Hole has estimated that Fukushima is 10 times worse for the aquatic systems than was Chernobyl.
Artie Gunderson is with Fairwinds Associates. He's the author of the Japanese book called Fukushima, The Truth and the Future. And Arnie, I'd like to turn our discussion to domestic issues and begin with some alarming news that continues to seep out from the Fort Calhoun nuclear station in Omaha, Nebraska. And as you and many of our listeners may know, it was flooded and was on the edge of a deluge and malfunction of even greater degree than it already suffered. And we are now hearing that there have been whistleblowers from inside the plant who are saying that the situation is worse, whether it's with crackage or brittleness or whether it's the consequences or implications of the fire that took place there. Do you have new information in regard to the conditions at Fort Calhoun?
Well, you know, Fort Calhoun is a small plant. It's only 500 megawatts, and most of the plants are twice as big. One of the first plants built, and it's owned by a little municipal called Omaha Public Power District. So they really don't have a big institution behind them to help them out. And they've got a staff of 500 or 600 people for this plant. And it's been shut down. They shut it down preemptively. Knowing the flood was coming, they decided, well, we're not going to start this sucker up. They kept it down. But the flood was so severe that it saturated the groundwater, and there still remains all sorts of questions about what the foundations are like. Then we had this discussion a year ago about the fire. They had some safety-related wiring catch fire, and the fuel pool was without cooling for a period of time as a result. And now they're in a cascading management breakdown where people are coming forward with more and more problems, and management is just is being inundated by problems that employees are bringing forward, whistleblowers and within their system. And they're so small, you know, that they can't rely on a larger institution to help them out. I've seen this happen before, and when a plant gets in this mode, you either, shut it down forever and say, you know, screw it, it's just not worth repairing this plant, it's too small. Or you say, if to do it right, we're going to be shut down for 2 years and begin a management process to tackle these problems one at a time. And eventually, you'll be solving them faster than they're arising. But right now, what's happening at Fort Calhoun is the problems are popping up faster than they can solve them.
Which takes us to the other major development of recent days. And that is the institution that does regulate or is nominally the regulator of nuclear power plant operations. There has been a climax to a stunning series of assaults on the leadership at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the person of the chair, Gregory Yasko. And having been dragged through congressional hearings about his, quote, management style, now he has announced his imminent resignation, presumably due to those ongoing pressures. What do you make of that makeover of the NRC currently?
You know, in the last 2 months, I've had two meetings with Chairman Yasko, and he is not anti-nuclear or anything like the nuclear industry portrays him to be. He's just a regulator trying to do his job, and the other four commissioners at the NRC simply believe that the industry has got adequate regulation and doesn't need to be regulated. What happened in the last couple months is that the nuclear industry, through its allies in Congress, was able to retaliate against the chairman and make his life so miserable that he just basically said, I'm going to resign. I don't need this anymore. He's been there 8 years, 5 years as a commissioner and 3 years as a chairman. And he was on Harry Reid's staff before that. The industry is very upset that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, under Yasko's tutelage, shut down the waste facility out at Yucca Mountain. And I think this is all about trying a desperation move to get Yucca Mountain started back up again. And in order for that to happen, the industry had to get rid of Chairman Yasko. And, it just got to the point where it was just too much for him. And I can't blame him. It was, you can't go through that many congressional hearings and pressure in the press and things like that. And stay, a coherent human being.
What is the strategic interest of the nuclear industry in resuscitating Yucca?
Well, Yucca is the only game in town. You know, it was without a waste facility to start the process again is going to take 10 or 20 more years. And the industry wanted to believe that Yucca was the right place to put nuclear fuel. It wasn't. Yucca was chosen by Congress in what was affectionately called the Screw Nevada Act, because it's near enough to where we tested bombs and things like that. And Nevada doesn't have many people to many votes in the House of Representatives. So it wasn't scientifically chosen; it was politically chosen, and yet the industry's been trying to backfit the science to match the politics for close to 20 years now. It's not a great site. There are better sites, but the process is going to have to start again, and the industry doesn't want to wait 20 more years. So we're trying. They're trying still. The House of Representatives just yesterday, I think, passed some sort of a bill encouraging the NRC to open up Yucca Mountain yet again. Now, of course, President Obama made a campaign pledge that Yucca wouldn't start up. So we've got a case where I would suspect if President Obama's reelected, Yucca will truly be dead. But if a Republican is elected, then it's likely that Congress will be able to start Yucca up after the election.
Unless President Obama continues to believe in change.
Right. Yes, you have it.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. That's Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. And you speak about the Yucca Mountain facility, but I think there might have been yet another reason why the other commissioners have pushed to have him ousted on behalf of the industry. And that is, I remember Gregor Yasko doing a public tour of the Fort Calhoun nuclear station at the time of its greatest jeopardy, and speaking about design basis errors, flaws, and taking into account the lessons learned from Fukushima. Do you think that's a factor also?
Oh, certainly. The plant I'm very active in now on the West Coast, San Onofre, he's also been very active, not trying to shut it down, but just a regulator trying to regulate. And unfortunately, at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, when you try to regulate, that's not something that the other four commissioners really want to happen.
Arnie Gunderson, there is yet another issue in regard to the operation of the NRC, and that is something that may actually be at issue in a meeting of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that is taking place right now, even as we speak. And this meeting comes amid what seems to be an inevitable push by the commission to allow the nation to be exposed to used nuclear reactors, reactors that have gone decades beyond their intended lifespan, that face embrittlement and cracks and other issues. Can you speak to the monumental extension of the lifespans of these plants under the NRC?
Well, most of the plants are over 30 years old in the United States, and a large fraction are pushing 40 years old. The oldest one is 43 years old. But there's a large group that came online between 1970 and 1976 that are now hitting their 40th birthday. The NRC pretty much routinely has granted all of them 20-year license extensions. Everyone that's applied has gotten it. There's about a 1.5-year process where they have to show the paperwork's in order and they move forward. The NRC has now started a process to take a look at licensing beyond 60 years. So you got the initial 40 plus this 20 giveaway that they're giving every reactor. And now they're looking at relicensing these reactors yet again from 60 to 80 and then from 80 to 100 years. There's obviously lots of mechanical problems that are going to be encountered. The two biggest in my mind is concrete. You know, concrete in the ground, anybody who's had a foundation in his house knows that over time the moisture in the ground attacks the concrete. And the groundwater underneath the base mat of these nuclear plants is attacking the concrete. It's incredibly difficult to look at the foundation underneath a nuclear plant. So I like to call it don't ask, don't tell. You know, the NRC is not asking about the condition of those foundations, and the industry is not telling about it, and everybody's happy. But so the biggest concern is, can concrete stay in the ground for 60 years and still be as rigorously certifiable as it needs to be in a nuclear plant? The second piece is the plastic, the insulation on wires. Now, anybody who's had an old wire and twisted it knows that the insulation snaps. And so it's not clear to me that you can expect the plastic insulation on all these wires to last 40 years, let alone 60 or 100.
So the NRC essentially wants nuclear power plants to have longer lifespans than the people who invented and designed them.
Yes, and probably their kids as well. You know, the industry's position is that, let's assume you've got a plant that's 50 years old. They need about 10 years to build a new power plant. So they need some assurance that a 50-year-old plant could be relicensed, or they've got to start building a new one. So they're pushing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to come up with a policy before these plants turn 50 years old, so that they know whether or not they need to build or whether they can rely on the old plant again. That was the industry side of this argument. But you know, my position is that these plants have been you squeezed as much orange as you can out of this orange juice, and now you're just down to the pulp, and it's time to dismantle it and start fresh.
Arne Gundersen, this has certainly been a long-awaited revelation in the many topics that you've covered today. And if there are things that I've not brought up or we've not said yet, I give you this closing moment for what concerned and aware people might do.
Well, let me just say one last thing, and thank you very much for having me. The nuclear industry would like us all to believe that nuclear power plants should run and that we can store the nuclear waste for 250,000 years. Those same people are saying that solar is impossible because we haven't figured out a way of storing sunlight overnight. Well, if we can store nuclear waste for 250,000 years, we can certainly figure out a way of storing electricity overnight so we can have baseload solar as well as baseload nuclear.
Well, thank you so much, Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates. The work and your many timely reports on such issues can be seen at the website fairwinds.com, and that's FAIREWINDS. And we also congratulate you on the successful tour and publication of your book, Fukushima, The Truth and the Future. And we'll stay in touch with you and be back. You'll be back real soon.
Thanks, Robert. It's always fun to talk with you.
And give our best to Maggie as well. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We'll be back with more after this.
Here's a thumbnail introduction to atomic energy. Here are some important highlights of atomic history. From the X-ray and electron and the quantum theory, down to Einstein and his formula for mass and energy. It, hooray, we've got atomic energy. It could mean a better world for all. It, hooray, for those who made it come to be. May we present the main events and heroes great and small.
1896, France.
Henri Becquerel finds that uranium ore is radioactive.
1905, Switzerland.
Albert Einstein shows that energy and matter are equivalent. E equals mc squared.
1913, Denmark.
Niels Bohr explains how atoms emit light as electrons jump from higher orbits to lower ones.
1938, Germany.
Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann split the uranium atom.
1942, United States of America.
Enrico Fermi builds the first atomic pile and shows that atomic energy is practical.
Hope and pray we use the power constructively to bring about a peaceful world.
for people great and small.
Glaser and Evans, along with Vic Sado, on the origin and consequences of nuclear power generation in the United States and around the world. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today has been a fast-breaking one for events regarding and surrounding the nation of Syria. Earlier, there was a United Nations meeting on the Kofi Annan mission to seek some kind of remedy for the opposition that continues with the fight in various parts of the country against the government there. There was a recommendation made that there be mediation now from the nations of Iran and the Soviet Union. And there is, even as we speak, a secret Security Council meeting underway. And publicly, though, just prior to that meeting, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that his nation would not countenance another military intervention by the United Nations, such as the one that led to the recent tragedy in the nation of Libya. And to help get a better perspective on all of this, we are now joined live by Professor Elaine Hagopian. She is a Syrian-American sociologist and a professor of sociology at Simmons College in Boston, Massachusetts, as well as a host for the Arabic Hour television program. And we Had these developments today, Elaine, along with Kofi Annan making a very mysterious and significant statement that in addition to the government and the armed opposition, that he saw evidence from recent bombings of what he referred to as a third actor in the situation in Syria. What do you make of all of that?
It has been clear for quite some time that there is an external actor doing a lot of the bombings around Damascus and Aleppo. Some people think it's al-Qaeda from Iraq. Others say al-Qaeda is weak. Others say, well, they have not gotten in on the Libyan and the Tunisian events and in Egypt as well, because their position is different from the Muslim Brothers who won out in these areas. Their position is one where they want to see the restoration of Islam throughout the area and the reestablishment of the caliphate. With Syria next door to Iraq and with a group that was called the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, some of these have turned around and come into Syria. Whether they are the responsible ones, whether they are Muslim Brothers that fought in Libya that were supported by Qatar, it's hard to tell. There are people there from Tunisia. There are people there from Morocco. There are even special forces, according to a WikiLeaks memo that the U.S. since last December has special operations forces in the area training members of the different militias of the Free Syrian Army insurgency. So the picture is always cloudy. It's very hard to pinpoint and get an accurate picture, but that there are external actors in Syria and that there have been attempts over the many, many years to weaken Syria, a very strategic area and location, and one connected by alliance to Iran and Hezbollah, and has not been willing to simply fall into the Western orbit. It's true, there are external actors. There's also a legitimate reform movement that has been overshadowed. And I've said this before, the reform movement was originally nonviolent. They are still there. A lot of the local coordinating committee people are part of that. But they've been overshadowed by the militarized opposition, which is being fed arms now and communication support by the U.S. And the money is coming from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and arms are being shipped into these people. And they are being trained more and more in insurgency, because a lot of the confrontational battles, the Syrian army had an advantage. Now you see that more Syrian military, official Syrian military, are being killed. More security forces are being killed. And so it's a very difficult picture. For me, the Annan plan is still the only plan in town. But both the regime and the opposition, the militarized opposition, said they will not recognize it. They will not adhere to it because they say the other party is not adhering to it. And finally, my only sense is that Russia, with Iran and with perhaps members of the BRICS nation, even though they don't really form an institutionalized group, whether that be China or India or including Brazil or South Africa on one side and the U.S. on the other side, with its allies, whether it be Turkey or whatever, really have to get these people to the table and has to negotiate something along the Annan plan, which does not call for the stepping down of the Assad regime, but of course implied within it is that eventually it means a transition where the Assad family really is no longer a factor. Other parties would be able to run. And the reason I think that that has to happen and could be a hope is because the regime basically has welcomed the BRICS statement that they did not want intervention by the UN against Syrian sovereignty. And Russia alone, I think, is not strong enough. And the U.S. does want to work with Russia, but it wants to really work on its own terms. And they don't want Iran involved, but now Iran and Russia are going to be involved in mediation. Someone has to have enough clout to bring these people to the table and to negotiate and stop all this violence.
Elaine Hagopian, your clarity on the complexities of this situation is stunning. And out of all of that, because this broadcast originates in the United States, I will ask you about this. You mentioned the bombings in Aleppo, which, if I recall the map correctly, is one of the major cities closest to Turkey.
Yes.
From which emanates the Libyan weapons under the control of Belhaj and the former Libyan Islamic fighting group that aligned with Al-Qaeda. So can you tell us about what NATO and perhaps U.S. Facilities are doing to put military or armed input into the situation?
Well, as far as we know, I mean, and again, I want to say to the audience, we don't have accurate information. We can get 10 different stories about the same topic from 10 different people. Everybody claims to have a contact in Syria. So, you know, but as far as we know, the U.S., and according to Joshua Landis, who is a expert on Syria, is really sort of pursuing regime change in Syria by civil war. That is, the U.S., Europe, and the Gulf states want regime change, so they are starving the regime in Damascus and feeding the opposition. They basically have allowed the Gulf states to shovel in money and helping arms supplied by the Gulf to get to the rebels. The U.S. is helping, according to Landis, and I'm reading from some of Landis's work. That Landis thinks that eventually, if these arms continue to flow, the U.S. continues sanctions, the special operations forces in the area, especially coming U.S. forces from the Turkey, we have bases there, training in insurgency, that the revolution may, as they call it, the revolution, I'm not sure it's a revolution, may have greater success. The regime cannot stop at this point because they know that stopping means their eventual demise. On the other hand, you cannot really engage in intervening in Syria, because if you destroy, you can get Assad to go, but the regime is there. And then if you want to get rid of the security forces, which really are the backbone of the regime and which have been doing a lot of the bloody murder, perhaps also with support from these mafia-like groups, the Shabiha, then, you know, you do what you did in Iraq. You get rid of the Ba'athist Party, you get rid of the basically the guys in the army and intelligence, and you're left with chaos. And the U.S. is not good at nation building. And as Landis has pointed out, and as we all know, we've looked at Afghanistan, we look at Iraq. Do we want all this chaos? Now, there was an interview with Ali Hashim, a former employee of Al Jazeera, who quit because Al Jazeera was putting out false information about Syria. And he is with a new group in Beirut, and also says it's hard to know, you know, what is going on. But he also says there is an external party. And when he was questioned by John Jay of the Real News, well, who is the third party, he didn't really want to say. And he said, well, you know, there are Arabs, there's Israel, there's, you know, so many actors who would like to see the regime implode. So what we can glean from all of this is that there is a great deal of violence going on in Syria. The militarized opposition is getting help from outside. The regime feels it cannot give up because it would mean its demise, and it also rankles them that this is part and parcel of a long history of trying to crush and collapse the regime. And in the meantime, the authentic reform movement, the need for change in Syria, because the regime is not only not democratic, but has been brutal in the past, that gets overshadowed, and people forget that. And they just keep focusing on the opposition and trying to build up the Free Syrian Army, which is not an army. It is a whole bunch of little militias, which they're trying to integrate. They're now trying to get the political group that they created, the Syrian National Council, which nobody pays attention to. They're supposed to be electing a new head, because Burhan Ghalioun was challenged by the members. The Muslim Brothers are strong. They're the greatest organized group in the opposition. And in the meantime, minorities are concerned, and both parties have played the sectarian role, making each fear the other. So it's now so out of hand that I do strongly feel that our last best hope is to get Russia, along with some of the BRICS country and Iran, because Iran has a lot of influence in Syria, as much as that makes the U.S. sick. But the U.S. cannot say it wants all its allies, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and whatnot, all of whom hate the regime, and not grant that there be something on the other side. It's like trying to get the balance that used to exist with the Cold War, and we don't have that right now. Russia is a very important actor, and it needs to orchestrate something. And has to make some equal demands. The U.S. can't have its total way, but, you know, both these parties are looking to have their interests met, and there must be some compromise. And the other problem, and let me just quickly say this, is they don't seem to be able to agree on who would replace Assad, because there's no figure that has come forth that would look like someone who could do the balancing act of allowing Russian interests in the area and at the same time, in some ways, giving some of the U.S. interests in the area as well. So there's no one there. And who to look for, where to find them. This just doesn't seem to be an alternative at this point to the regime. So the Annan plan allows the regime to stay, but at the same time wants to trigger actions that will lead to, in a sense, a greater plurality, greater voting, and the regime, in essence, being voted out of office. So it's not an easy question, and yet it's a very strategic area.
Elaine Hagopian, your clarity is stunning, and your informational density per unit word is equally so. In the closing 2 minutes or so that we have, you have described a multiplex of interests or stakeholders inside Syria. You've got the Alawite constituencies, the Sunni, the Shia, and many, many others. If the United States and nations like Qatar, which has certainly been interventionist in the region, Israel, Britain, France, and who knows how many others, if they are also using ethnic and religious enmity as a means of creating instability, can that be contained to merely inside Syria?
Well, this is of course the core issue. They have unleashed some really awful some awful powers, and Qatar has played a filthy role along with Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Saudis put in Salafis, you know, really fundamentalists. Qatar supports the Muslim Brothers, and the regime has made the minorities feel like if they go, then they'll be subjected to a extremist Muslim group. What has to be made clear is that the majority of the Sunni population in Syria, which it makes up 70% of the population, are not violent people. They are filled with anger over 1982. They did try to rebel. They did try to cause problems for Hafez al-Assad. And Hafez al-Assad's brother, Rifat, led the charge and killed thousands of them. And I fear that Maher, the brother of Bashar, is very much like his uncle. He leads the security apparatus. And I sometimes get the feeling that he is perhaps the leader of the greatest amount of brutality that comes out of the regime. On the other hand, the opposition is not slacking in their brutality and in their killing of civilians as well. In any case, it's really first trying to get people to the table, trying to identify within the community, especially coming out of the northern area, Idlib and in Aleppo, where you have mostly Sunni Muslims, people who are sane and who want quiet. The Muslim Brothers will have to have a role in the future of Syria.
Elaine, that's where we're going to have to leave it, but mm-hmm. I recommend that you be followed on the Arabic Hour TV.
Thank you.
And your work at Simmons College in Boston, where you are a sociologist and a professor thereof. Where else can people catch your work?
Well, if they want to watch Arabic Hour online, it's www.arabichour.org. And thank you very much. I appreciated this interview.
As do we, and I think all of our audience. Elaine Hagopian.
Thank you.
And this concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. And the program was produced by Thiago Barroso and engineered by Reggie Johnson and Michael G. Haskins. And we welcome your comments, queries, suggestions, tips, and leaks with an email to theshadow, T-H-E-S-H-A-D-O-W, theshadow@wbai.org, or send us a letter to 5 O'Clock Shadow at WBAI 120 Wall Street, New York 10005. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.